says, "We love you." And Sal looks at the floor and says, "Good luck." "You're going to win," I say. "I know it." "Don't get your hopes up," Mom says. And then we watch her disappear behind a door. We walk into the studio, which is like a theater with all the $20,000 pyramid stuff up on the stage. Dick Clark's podium is there, and the word screens that swivel back and forth during the speed round, and two empty chairs facing each other in the winner's circle. Everything looks artificial and kind of gloomy in the dim light. I'm thinking that one good shove could probably knock the whole thing over. There are a lot of people in the theater already, and we get seats about halfway back. They are red velvety seats, the kind you have to fold down before you sit on them. A guy with headphones comes out and talks to the audience about when to clap and when to be quiet. He points to these metal boxes attached to the ceiling that light up like exit signs, only they say, "Applause," instead of "exit." He explains that the signs will blink on and off to help us remember when to clap and when to stop. We have to practice with him. Clap, stop. Clap, clap, stop. It's a little silly, but Louisa and Richard are taking it very seriously. Sal and I laugh and dare each other to clap at the wrong time. The stage lights come on, and suddenly the whole set is glowing like July at the beach. Much more cheerful. Richard takes my hand. Dick Clark comes out and says hi to the audience, and Louisa starts talking about how she has always liked Dick Clark, how he has always seemed like one of the nicest people on television, and how now that she sees him, she thinks she likes him even more. "Isn't it amazing?" she asks. "How he never seems to age? He looks just the same today as he did back in 1956. She says she might ask him for some autographs after the show for the old people at her nursing home, because she's sure they would get a big kick out of that. Louisa is talking even faster than Mrs. Bindocker at the monthly tenant meeting. And then suddenly she is quiet. I look at her and see that she's biting her lips. Everything starts to happen very fast. There is music. Dick Clark makes a funny face like he's afraid he might be late, and he hops over to his podium. The celebrities take the stage. I've never heard of either one of them. The next thing I know, Mom is coming out with her hair clamped back in barrettes, looking smaller than ever. But she's wonderful. The speed round is a thing of beauty. Mom gets 7 words out of 7 every time and wins the cash bonus. Her celebrity is not as dumb as a bag of hair. In fact, her celebrity is not remotely dumb. The other contestant is good, but his celebrity speaks too slowly and says the word bat while giving clues for the word batter, an amateur's mistake. They lose that point and a couple of others. Before I know it, Dick Clark is leading Mom over to the winner's circle. "This is it," I hear Richard whisper to himself. $10,000. $10,000, my brain says. $10,000! Mom's celebrity looks determined. Mom looks scared. Dick Clark is smiling. He's the only one who looks relaxed. He's chatting with Mom for a minute, and I know Mom is trying to focus. To lift a corner of her veil so that she'll be able to see the big things, so that she can see the thread. Dick Clark is still talking, and I realize we never practiced the chatting. I am suddenly afraid. I am hearing the ocean. How can Mom lift her veil and see the magic thread with Dick Clark talking to her about her stupid job? I focus on Mom and try to help her concentrate. Louisa is getting nervous again, and she starts whispering about Dick Clark. "He doesn't age, I tell you. Dick Clark simply does not age. It's amazing." I'm chanting to myself, "Magic thread, magic thread." And I'm staring at Mom so hard that my eyes are almost aching. Finally, Dick Clark is done chatting. "Here is your first subject," he says. "Go." Then the strangest thing happens. Magic thread. Mom is jumping up and down, and I hear the sound of hundreds of people cheering and clapping, lifting me like a wave and carrying me. I am out of my seat. I am floating down the aisle. People are patting me on the back or reaching out to squeeze my arm. And then the stage is in front of me. I'm going up some steps, and then light is everywhere. Too bright, and it's hot. Mom is still leaping around. She's hugging her celebrity. She's hugging Dick Clark. One of her barrettes is down by the side of her face, hanging on for dear life and banging against her cheek. She hugs me, and my head is pulled up and down as she jumps, so that I'm forced to jump with her. I feel happy. I smile and grab Mom's hands and jump up and down with her. I let go of her and raise my arms over my head and feel the audience roar louder. I am not thinking of the wall-to-wall carpet or the camera or the trip to China. I am jumping up and down because at the very moment Dick Clark said the word go, it was like an invisible hand reached out and snatched away my veil. And for almost a minute, I understood everything. When that veil isn't hanging down right in front of a person's face, a minute is long enough to realize a lot of things. I realized that when you took our key from the fire hose, when you left me the notes, when you stole Richard's shoes and Jimmy's Fred Flintstone bank, you had already read my letter. You had read it many times, even though I have not yet written it. That's how you knew where the key was, even before you asked. That's how you knew everything. I will tell you in my letter, the letter you asked me to write. But that's impossible, my brain squawked. You're saying the Laughing Man read a letter that you haven't even written yet. It makes no sense. Common sense is just a name for the way we're used to thinking. Time travel is possible. You came to save Sal. And finally, I understood. Dick Clark never ages. I thought of what Marcus had said about going to the movies in my time machine, that if I didn't leave until I was 62, the ticket guy wouldn't recognize me. I might not even recognize myself. Maybe Dick Clark never ages, but the rest of us will. I will. Sal will, thanks to you. And Marcus will, too. Please deliver your letter by hand, your note said. You know where to find me. I thought of the beat-up metal door next to the garage, and I thought, yes, I do. Because you are still here, after all, to read my letter. Marcus is here. And when he reads the letter, he'll realize that he has seen himself arrive before he left. That's what my letter is for. And then, in who knows what year, the year of the burn scale, the year of the dome, Marcus will come back. You will come back. You will come back with a mouthful of paper. You won't be yourself when you reach me, but you will get the job done. You will save Sal. You already have. Marcus is the magic thread. You are the Laughing Man. You are Marcus. Marcus is the Laughing Man. Or he will be when he's old. Not if it makes sense, my brain yelled. But all of it is true. I answered. Like I said, it lasted just under a minute. It lasted 55 seconds, to be precise, which is how long it took Mom to guess 6 categories and win $10,000. And then Mom and I are on the stage together, jumping up and down until they make us get off. Things That Open. We take the bus home because we think it'll be so much fun to take the bus home, knowing that we are rich now and can take a cab anytime we want. And it is fun. Sal and I don't talk much, but we lean into the turns the way we used to when we were little and actually believed that we could make the bus tip over. After Mom won her $10,000, she played another speed round, but this time she had to be partners with the other celebrity. He wasn't as dumb as a bag of hair, Mom says on the bus. But he wasn't the sharpest knife in the drawer, either. They lost. but Mom gets to keep her $10,000 and her $2,100 cash bonus. Not bad for a day's work, she says, smiling at me. Not bad at all. When we get to the lobby, Luisa has to change into her uniform for work. Want to watch some TV? Sal asks me. I tell him I would love to. Another time. Upstairs, Mom puts on a record, and she and Richard dance for a while in the living room while I sit on the couch and grin, just watching them. Then I go to my room, shut my door, and pull the box out from under my bed. Right on top of everything is a big envelope for Mom. Richard gave it to me a week ago for safekeeping. And underneath it is Richard's birthday present. Mom is in the kitchen, making birthday tacos and a box cake. Every once in a while she yells, "Woohoo! We're rich!" I write on Mom's envelope with a marker. I personally do not care about wall-to-wall carpeting. Luisa says carpets are full of dust mites anyway. I make an origami frog for Richard and put it on top of his box. I make an origami frog for Mom and put it on top of her envelope. I can't get enough of these origami frogs. It's time for dinner. We eat the tacos. We sing. We cut the cake. I give Mom her envelope. What's this? She says. It's not my birthday. She admires her frog. She reads my note about the carpeting and the dust mites and gives me a funny look. She opens the envelope, which is full of applications for law school. She looks at them. But I can't. Then she sits back in her chair and says, "Wow." This was our secret plan all along, mine and Richard's. I give Richard his present. He admires his frog and puts it on the table next to Mom's frog so that their little frog feet are touching. He opens the box. Inside are two keys, one for the lobby door and one for the apartment. I made a key ring for them. It's a sailor's knot, two strands pulled tight. He knows how to untie it, of course, but I don't think he will. Things that blow away. The next morning, I wake up early, cut myself a big piece of Richard's birthday cake for breakfast, and start writing the letter. I'm writing it in the journal with the clouds on the cover that Mom gave me for Christmas. I'm at the top of the second page when it dawns on me that this letter I'm writing is kind of a horrible burden, and I start feeling really sorry for Marcus. It's not a letter that most people would want to get. I know it will be a big relief to know that he didn't accidentally cause the laughing man's death, your death, after all. That's a good thing. But at the same time, he'll understand that he saw his own death, which I have to think is a very hard thing. And he'll also realize that he's going to discover the secret of traveling through time, which is a thing so incredible that most people would consider it a miracle. Of course, he's the total hero of the story. But there isn't a happy ending for him. I start at the very beginning, when you first showed up in the fall, and I'm thinking about everything you did. The spot on the corner where you stood, your kicking practice, the way you muttered to yourself, book, bag, pocket, shoe. There was a reason for all of it. Except for one thing. I don't understand why you used to lie on the ground with your head under the mailbox. Why? It must have been annoying the way kids were always banging on it. I raise my head slowly from the journal. Then I get dressed in a hurry, pulling a sweater on over my pajama top. I leave a note on the kitchen table, grab my keys, and slip out of the apartment before Mom and Richard wake up. It's an almost warm morning. No one is on the corner, which is good, because I probably look pretty strange lying face up on the sidewalk and inching myself under the mailbox. It isn't as easy as I thought it would be. The underside of a mailbox is really ugly, a bunch of paint-splattered metal joints and bolts. I see the square of paper right away. It's small, about the same size as the notes you left me, and it's wedged under a metal seam so that it stays flat against the bottom of the box. I realize that it's held there with a key. Our old key. The one we hid in the fire hose. I adjust my head so that I'm looking straight up at the paper, the way you must have. A woman's face stares down at me, drawn in pencil. She's old, like you were. Her white hair is pulled back behind her head. Her dark eyes are looking to the side a little, and she has this playful smile. It's really kind of a beautiful drawing. People can get old all different ways, I guess. Some people change a lot, like you. I could have stared at your face for a week, and I never would have guessed that you were Marcus. You were so much thinner than he is, and the bones above your eyes stuck out. Maybe that was because of what you put yourself through. All the diamond jumping. But the old woman's face in the drawing still holds some youth. It's the dark eyes, maybe, or the smile. It's hard to say exactly how we recognize other people. But I know without a shadow of a doubt that this woman is Julia. Marcus and Julia. I think about how she whipped her diamond ring off and used it to explain the way she sees time, and the way Marcus stared at her afterward. Maybe he was thinking that he wasn't alone in the world after all. I get this rush of happiness, this flood of relief. Marcus won't be alone. He'll have a partner. He'll have Julia. I'm wiggling out from under the mailbox. Some guy with a big black dog is looking at me funny. And I suddenly remember what you said to me, practically on this exact spot, the afternoon I gave you my soggy cheese sandwich. I am an old man, and she is gone now, so don't worry, okay? I believe that you were ready, but I still think it's sad. I leave the drawing there, wedged underneath the mailbox with our key. It doesn't seem right to take it. I figure it will be there for a long time, and then, someday, it'll just blow away. Sal and Miranda, Miranda and Sal. Sal and I don't wait for each other these days. Not purposely, but if we happen to be leaving school at the same time, if he isn't going to a friend's or to basketball practice, and I'm not going to Anne-Marie's or Julia's or Colin's, then Sal and I walk home together. And we are better this way. Together because we want to be. He understood that before I did. We walk up to Broadway, past Jimmy's. We walk to Amsterdam, past the garage, where the boys still say stuff to us and we ignore them. We walk past Marcus's door. We pass Bell's. We cross the last street, to your old corner, where the mailbox is still scratched up with your words. And when we are safely across, Sal always gives a little salute, and sometimes I look up and shake my fists at the sky. Parting gifts. My letter is almost finished now. Very soon I will bring it to Marcus, just like you asked. There are things I could tell him, things I think I've figured out, like that those naked guys, the ones running down the street the days we had to eat lunch in the school cafeteria, and the one I saw flickering in and out before the accident, they were all you, learning how to get here, practicing. You'd said you couldn't carry anything, and I guess that includes clothes. That's why you carried my notes in your mouth. Or I could give Marcus some advice, like if he gets hungry while he's visiting, he'll find Anne-Marie's perfectly good lunch in the garbage can across from the schoolyard, where she threw it away every day for 6 weeks. But I'm pretty sure you figured that out for yourself. Or I could tell him about Julia. But I've decided I won't say much. I'll just hand him my letter and say, try not to land in the broccoli. He'll understand. He's a smart kid. This is Cynthia Holloway. We hope you've enjoyed this unabridged production of When You Reach Me by Rebecca Stead. This program was produced by Dan Musselman and directed by Jessica Kay. Text copyright 2009 by Rebecca Stead. Production copyright 2009, Random House, Inc. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.